This is Westward. Westward is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network and iHeartRadio. Episode 7, It's Showtime.
From the mid-1960s through the 1970s, one of the most popular nightclubs in Los Angeles could be found on the 2600 block of Wilshire in Santa Monica, called The Horn.
Thank you very much.
Owned by Enrique Riccardi and his wife Margaret, The Horn was known for featuring some of the best singers and entertainers in Hollywood. One such singer was a beautiful redhead born in Caracas, Venezuela, but raised in Ohio, named Sunny Wells.
Those were the years when comedians would open up or singers would open up, and singers would open for comedians, so you'd do a half hour and 45 minutes. You were called the opening act. So I opened for Don Rickles and David Brenner, David Fry, a lot of Davids, I just remember. Smothers Brothers, things like that.
Sunny Wells, who once dated Elvis Presley, would become a regular at The Horn.
You go to places where you can be seen.
76-year-old Barry Lee, an actor and entertainer who also worked at The Horn, was another.
The Horn was strictly and absolutely professionals. On a Friday and a Saturday night, the crowds literally lined around the block to get in. So people didn't have to call or look in the papers. Whoever was there was going to be great, and it was going to be a great show.
It was just everybody of the day.
Sammy Shore, Vicky Carte, Jackie Curtis.
And there were famous sports guys. Will Chamberlain used to be sitting next to Willie Schumacher, and it was very funny.
Johnny Mathis, Jim Nabors was discovered there.
Goldie Hawn, and she was trying to make it. Lily Tomlin was trying to make it. Bette Midler was trying to make it.
Betty White and her husband, and they would get polluted. I mean, she was one hell of a drinker.
Carol Burnett was pretty exciting, because when I got up to sing, when she was there, I got up and said, "I'm so glad we had this time together." She thought that was cute.
The spectacle and presentation of performances at The Horn were what was most attractive to many of the club's biggest patrons, including a wealthy real estate investor named Jerry Buss.
He was always there. Every time I went there, he was always there.
Rick and Margaret, they were terrific. Rick had light bulbs hanging around the room. On all the tables was a candle, you know, the little lit candle in the bowl thing. And then, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Horn. It's showtime.
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 That was a showtime move.
Here they go again. It's showtime.
Long before Jerry Buss came up with the idea of showtime, there was a coin toss, an incident that lends credence to the belief that while individual sports and competition are almost always predetermined by the Olympian principle of Sitius, Altius, Fortius, team sports seem to be governed by not just an alternate state of rules, but an invisible one. A championship team's genesis is often rooted in fate, its ascension wed to the magic of chance, and its achievement to the will of destiny. No team knows this better than the Los Angeles Lakers. Such would be the case on April 19th, 1979. When the franchise again would have to rely upon the whim of fortune in the form of a coin toss to put them on the path of their destiny, says Tim Livingston.
If you really trace the roots of Showtime, it starts with the drafting of Magic Johnson, sure, but it really started with an ending, and that ending was the Lakers parting ways with Gail Goodrich. Goodrich was 33, wanted a big contract, and the Lakers wisely, it turns out, didn't want to give him a lot of money. And the team that did? The Utah Jazz. To sign Goodrich, the league mandated that Jazz had to compensate the Lakers, so Utah had a choice. Players, money, or picks. they chose picks and gave the Lakers three first-round picks in 77, 78, and 79, plus a second-round pick in 1980. And almost immediately after signing with the Jazz, Goodrich tears his Achilles, and the Jazz turn into one of the worst teams in the league. So cut to the 1979 draft. The bottom-dwelling Bulls and the Lakers, armed with Utah's first pick, the coin toss takes place in New York at NBA headquarters. Neither the Bulls or Lakers are there. They're both on speakerphone. And NBA Commissioner Larry O'Brien asks Bulls GM Rod Thorne to make the pick. Thorne calls heads. The coin goes up. Dramatic pause. It comes down. Tails. And the rest is history.
While it would only be fitting that the greatest beneficiary of the coin toss would be a coin collector himself, the actual winner had already lost the Los Angeles Laker team. Owner Jack Kent Cook remembers his son John.
Dad had the club for so many years and it had become extremely successful. But in the 70s, he had some personal problems, and it ended in a divorce with my mother. And at that point, he had said, I have to sell, and I've had enough.
Jack Kent Cook's divorce would be the most expensive in U.S. history, costing him over $41 million in a settlement that landed the Laker owner in the Guinness Book of World Records. He needed money. And while his primary holding, the Great Western Forum, was profitable, the team he built it for, the NHL's LA Kings, hadn't quite captured the fan base he'd imagined.
There were, at that time, at least 200,000 Canadians there, but they didn't support the LA Kings, and Dad said it was probably came to LA because they hated hockey.
Fortunately for Cook, the Forum's other tenant, the Lakers, had plenty of fans, and many were very wealthy, including the coin collector, who had been hounding him for years.
Jerry Buss wanted the Lakers badly, and Dad knew that.
But there was a problem, as recalled by his close friend Ira Goldberg.
He wanted the Lakers. He became good friends with Jack Kent Cook. He's negotiating with Jack Kent Cook and not getting very far. So it just so happens that the Indiana Pacers becomes available, and he decides he's going to go ahead and he buys the Indiana Pacers. But it was a sweetheart deal for him. And not long after, it was on a Sunday afternoon, because he called me, was at Jack Kent Cook's house, poolside, and he just says, I need to get rid of the Pacers. I just bought the Lakers and the Forum. I can't own two NBA teams.
Another minor wrinkle was that Laker owner Jack Kent Cook's asking price was nearly $68 million. And Jerry Buss didn't have it.
Jerry Buss had money, but not that kind of money. Most of his net worth was tied up in real estate, not to mention he had just bought the Pacers. So, never deterred, Jerry calls his good friend Ira Goldberg.
He asked me, would you take an interest in it? He said, well, I think my friend Donald Sterling will buy the majority of it. Donald backed out. I think that started a problem between him and Donald. He says, you don't know anything about the basketball business, but I'll make you a deal. He says, you buy 20% of the Indiana Pacers, you can take all the short-term capital losses, and at the end you can cash out if you want, and it'll be long-term capital gain, but that'll be the deal. And I says, okay.
With one problem solved, Jerry Buss would move swiftly to solve his other minor problem, the team's $68 million price tag, a price even owner Jack Kent Cook wasn't sure Jerry Buss could meet.
Jerry Buss was in a peculiar real estate business. He had houses, thousands of them, in California and in Nevada and I think Arizona as well. And the sale was hinged upon him selling all these places. Dad looked at me and said, how in the hell is this guy going to sell all these houses?
Jerry Buss gets a lot of credit for architecting the Lakers and Showtime, but his greatest achievement was just pulling off the purchase, which was one of the most complicated in sports history, because even after he sold everything, he was still coming up short. So to sweeten his side of the deal, he offered Jack Kent Cook something he didn't even own, but knew Cook would want, and that was the Chrysler Building in New York City.
Well, Jerry Buss. And he told my father that there was a provision in the IRS tax code where you have like exchanges. And we traded it for the Chrysler Building, thanks to Jerry Buss.
But even after all the selling and trading and fiscal maneuvering Jerry Buss would have to go through, he would still need nearly $2 million to consummate the deal. And desperate to come up with this final shortfall, Buss would then go back to his old business associate, the same one he offered his share of the Indiana Pacers to before Ira Goldberg took them, Donald Sterling.
They were in the same circle. They knew each other well. And when Jerry needed that little extra bit of cash, he went to none other than Donald Sterling.
Although the deal with Jerry Buss and Jack Kent Cooke would move forward, it would not be official until after the 1979 NBA draft. This would make the decision on who to select more complicated. As sports writer and author of the book Showtime, Jeff Perlman shares, drafting the Wunderkind from East Lansing was not a fait accompli.
There was sincere, true debate with the Lakers. If we get the number one pick, are we taking Sidney Moncrief from Arkansas? Or are we taking Magic Johnson from Michigan State? Magic Johnson is considered this prize, but the other thing is a 6'9 point guard going to work in the NBA? You're going against all these little short, what, tiny Archibald, guys like that.
There was also a rumor that Jerry West, who had been retained by Buss as an advisor, didn't want Johnson as well, and that was not true.
I want to revisit, just for setting the record straight, how Magic became a Laker, and a lot of people falsely assumed that you passed on him. You did. So please set the record straight on that, Jerry.
I have heard this for years, and frankly, it gets annoying, okay? Mm-hmm. At that point in time, let me tell you where this started, okay? I got a call from Rod Thorne, and I was an advisor, okay? I was nothing. And Rod Thorne, who's one of my best friends, he's from West Virginia, played in the NBA, coach, general manager, a couple of different places. He called me, and he said to me, he said, you know, some, we'll offer you the second pick in the draft and also a couple of players off their team who were good players. And so I said to I said to Mr. Cook, and I'm not sure who the general manager was. I said, look, Chicago made us this offer, okay? Do you want me to look at it a little bit more? And I said, it's interesting. But I said, I don't think that's something we're going to do anyway, okay? The answer was no. And that was it.
The 19-year-old Johnson's pre-draft visit to Los Angeles wouldn't help the likelihood for his draft either.
They fly Magic out to meet with Jack Kent Cooke, and they bring him, and he's going to have this fancy meal at the Forum, and it's Sand Dad's, and it's Magic and his dad. He's a guy, blue collar, East Lansing, Michigan. Jack Kent Cooke, not a very likable guy, and like kind of an aristocratic guy and snobby, and Magic Johnson's looking at the Sand Dad's, he's poking around with his fork, and he doesn't know what this thing is, but it's disgusting looking. And he says, guys, have a cheeseburger. And they bring him a burger. And Jack Kent Cooke was so horrified by the rejection of Sand Dad's.
Rejection of his Sand Dad's notwithstanding. Ultimately, Jack Kent Cooke, who had built the Lakers a sense of place, would then make the pick that would define a new era in professional basketball.
The Los Angeles Lakers select Irvin Magic Johnson, Michigan State, 6'8", 200 pounds.
You are listening to Westward on the Dan Patrick Podcast Network. We'll be right back. On June 22, 1979, the deal between Dr. Jerry Buss and Jack Kent Cooke finally became official. The new Laker owner had inherited a team with two former number one picks in Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Irving Johnson, an all-star forward in Jamar Wilkes, and a first-team all-rookie guard in Norm Nixon. But Buss also seemed to have inherited a team whose good fortune may have run out, the first sign of which would come when he tried to hire the coach previous owner Jack Kent Cooke had tried 2 years earlier.
Jerry Tarkanian is a successful coach at UNLV. He's a little ethically skippy. He's an ethically sketchy coach, but he's very successful. And Jerry Buss decides this is a guy I'm going to hire to coach the Lakers. And he interviews him for the job, and Tarkanian is very interested in the job, and he's going to take the job. And then his agent winds up dead in the trunk of a car. Like, his agent literally winds up dead in the trunk of a car.
The maroon and white 1977 Rolls Royce was found parked on the second level of a garage at the Sheraton Universal Hotel in North Hollywood after a Sheraton parking lot attendant had taken notice of the smell. When police arrived, they found the decaying body of a man in its trunk. It was Victor Weiss, Jerry Tarkanian's agent.
That threw off everything, and Jerry Tarkanian all of a sudden wasn't really ready mentally or emotionally, and he stayed at UNLV.
Buss would then turn to the highly regarded assistant coach of the Portland Trail Blazers, Jack McKinney.
McKinney was a highly regarded basketball coach. He'd been the head coach at St. Joe's in Philadelphia, was a really, really good coach, had been around Bill Walton in Portland, around Jack Ramsey in Portland, came to L.A., was thrilled with what he had to work with. They love Jack McKinney, and the Lakers get off to a great start.
The Lakers would jump out to a 9-4 record before misfortune would strike once again.
And then they have an off day, and Jack McKinney decides, asks Paul Weston if he wants to play tennis. So he rides his bicycle, and he stops short. He's not wearing a helmet, and he flips over the handlebars and lands on his head on the concrete. This is how early in the NBA. I mean, it's actually crazy. He was the head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, and he shows up at the hospital as a John Doe. They do not know who he is. You know, and he suffered major, major damage. And that was the end.
With McKinney's head injury, his assistant Paul Westhead would have to take the reins of coaching on an interim basis. Westhead learned the game of basketball on the streets of Philadelphia as a youth. And despite never having played in high school while at Philadelphia's West Catholic, he still managed to get a scholarship to St. Joe's, where he played for future Hall of Fame coach Jack Ramsey.
Jack Ramsey, who turned my whole life around as a person and as a coach, so I kind of modeled myself after Coach Ramsey. I wouldn't say I always wanted to be a coach. My goal going through college as I was playing was that I was going to be a teacher. I liked the classroom, and after I graduated from St. Joe's, I spent 2 years getting my master's. But, you know, deep down inside, I always wanted to get involved with basketball. And I remember my first possible job interview, I called Jack Ramsey and said, "Hey, can you help me?" He said, "I'll make a call for you. But you're really not a coach. You're destined to be a teacher. So I don't know if you're going to be a very good coach." And he made the call.
Westhead didn't get the job. Instead, it was Ramsey's successor at St. Joe's, Jack McKinney, who would give Paul Westhead his first big break as head coach at Philadelphia's LaSalle University.
I worked for McKinney for 2 years, and he helped me get the LaSalle job. And it's kind of interesting. He helped me get the LaSalle job, and then he is the one who hired me as his assistant for the Los Angeles Lakers. So even though Ramsey was the one who kind of molded me, McKinney is the one who delivered me.
With McKinney out, Paul Westhead would now have to deliver for the Los Angeles Lakers.
I was their only choice. By that I mean Jack was injured on a Tuesday, and Wednesday morning we had a shoot around because we had a game that night. And if I didn't show up, well, the trainer would have been in charge, because back then there was the head coach and one assistant coach, and they were kind of at least temporarily stuck with me. So I was like a substitute teacher who the lesson plan was left on the desk, and I followed the lesson plan.
Lakers owner Jerry Buss would make very clear that Paul Westhead's substitute coaching duties would be on an interim basis.
After the first game, I talked to Jerry Buss, and he said, "Okay, well, there's a couple more games coming up this weekend. We want you to stay on with us as our coach." And he said, "We'll talk, you know, in a few days." And I think we won two or three of our first few games, so at least there was a little relaxation. Had we lost that opening game, I probably would have coached my last game. we were losing, and with about 10 seconds to go, Jamal Wilkes gave one of his classic jump shots that he just flings the ball.
To Wilkes, a 17-foot slingshot is good. David hit Goliath again. Timeout, 78-78.
You don't never know how it would ever go in, but it did.
But Paul Westhead's bigger win would be with the Laker players, in particular, their all-star center and captain, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Instinctively, what I learned about Kareem is you don't want to overwhelm him with your ability and how smart you are. Or, hey, Kareem, if you would just drop your shoulder a little bit, it might go a little better. So I was at least smart enough to know, leave perfection alone. Like the guy has his own style and he's the best in the world. So anyway, that allowed Kareem to size me up. And from that time on, we were friends. We talked about literature a little bit, a little poetry occasionally, but it was always on his terms. If he didn't want to talk to you, just leave him alone. That meant he didn't want to talk to you. So I wasn't pushy, and I think that really helped our relationship.
He had also won over the new rookie, Magic Johnson, before the two even met.
I showed up for the first practice at Inglewood High. That's where the team practiced then. We had no facility, and this was a high school gym that they rented out, a couple days a week. I showed up and Magic Johnson was there. And after practice, I went back to talk to him and he said, well, I talked to Coach Daly. That was Chuck Daly, who we knew from the Detroit area. And he said, Coach Daly said you were a good guy because Daly and I coached against each other in Philadelphia. So with Daly's endorsement, Magic, welcomed me.
More than a month after taking over, Paul Westhead had the Lakers winning, had Laker owner Jerry Buss happy, and had Laker fans in a frenzy. But what he didn't have was an assistant coach.
I actually had one of the players try and help me. Was Don Ford. I said, hey, could you check some things during the game? And he did it for a couple games. He said, Coach, I don't want to do this anymore.
While Paul Westhead had only coached at the collegiate level, the assistant he would ask for had never coached at any level. In fact, he was working on his broadcasting career as Chick Hearn's color man for Laker games. His name was Pat Riley.
Pat, the word incredible doesn't even cover it. This is some kind of a super year.
Well, Chick, based on the opinions of a lot of people back last April the 19th and throughout the summer, I think the players have really taken that criticism to heart.
I asked Jerry Buss if we could hire Pat Riley. Buss initially was not happy with that. You didn't want to rock the boat. You don't want to get Chick mad at anything. Chick was really the boss. I mean, Jerry Buss bought the team, but I don't know if he realized he also bought Chick Hearn, who ran the team. Eventually, Chick said to Riley, yes, you can leave. And that's how Pat Riley became my assistant.
While Paul Westhead, Pat Riley, and the Lakers would go on to change the way the game was played, new owner Jerry Buss went about changing the way it was presented, says Jeff Perlman.
Jerry Buss, he saw this as much more than just sports. Like a lot of the other owners saw it as this is a team I own and they play a sport. And Jerry Buss saw it as I own an entertainment venue. We're going to give fans cheerleaders in short skirts. We're going to give fans a marching band that they can hear. It's not just going to be piped in organ music. And we're going to give them personalities.
Jerry Buss would give fans even more. Laker games at the Fabulous Forum were equal parts Hollywood production, musical theater, and athletic competition.
Jerry Buss accomplished two incredible things his first year as an owner. Number one, he won an NBA title, which is obviously an incredible feat in and of itself. But number two, he made the Lakers into LA's main attraction. He created a new synergy between sports and entertainment that thrust the NBA and its stars into the forefront of American culture.
Here is is Magic. 39. He's still perfect at the free throw line.
I think he might be the favorite in L.A. for a few weeks when he gets old.
Magic of the World Championship. They're going to have to widen the wall at the Fabulous Forum to handle another World Championship banner.
The Showtime era is the precursor for what we now know as the NBA. Basketball players as celebrities, not just as athletes. If you look at it at the time before Magic came to L.A. and before Bird came to Boston, basketball players weren't celebrities. I grew up a kid in New York. I would never see the Denver Nuggets play basketball or the Atlanta Hawks. It just wasn't a thing. And Showtime specifically comes along and it just changes everything.
One thing that hadn't changed was Paul Westhead's interim coaching status. Even after winning the championship his first year, Laker owner Jerry Buss was torn as to whether he would keep Westhead. His problem was Jack McKinney. The coach Paul Westhead had stepped in for had recovered from his accident, and Buss didn't know what to do with him. To solve this problem, Buss once again would turn to his old friend, Ira Goldberg.
We had a coach. It was a problem. He liked to drink. So Jerry was having a problem at the time with his coach. He got in an accident. And Jerry wanted to get rid of him. The press was all over him. How could you fire a guy when he was in a bicycle accident? He says, Ira, I got to make this go away. Can you hire him? And I said, absolutely. We got a problem with the team anyways.
The Pacers would then hire Jack McKinney so that Jerry Buss could hire Paul Westhead.
Talk about a thankless situation. I mean, one of his closest friends in basketball slams his head into the cement going to play tennis with him. And then he takes over, and basically, because of his success, his best friend, the previous coach, is no longer invited to coach the team. I mean, that's Shakespearean times 1,000 and heartbreaking.
Because of the mitigating circumstances, Coach Paul Westhead was never able to fully celebrate either his success nor his full-time status as the Laker coach.
As an assistant coach, and because of an unfortunate accident suffered by Jack McKinney, he directs the Lakers to the World Championship. But if I had to guess, I would say that both Jack McKinney and Paul Westhead's names will appear on the championship plaque.
Yeah, winning was terrific. It was one of the thrills of a coaching lifetime. But it was a mixed time in my life. I was happy and sad, kind of back and forth.
The back and forth would continue through Paul Westhead's second season, as both he and the Lakers would experience the hardships of defending their title along with the growing pains of a burgeoning dynasty.
When you win a championship, whoever you play the next year, even if it's, you know, the team that's last in the league and you should win by 25 points, they have marked this game. They're gunning for you. This can make their season. If we can beat the Lakers, you know, we'll have credibility. So every one of the 82 league games, it's the most important game for the opposition. It might not be for you. You know, you're in game 17 and you could care less, kind of, but they care, the opponent. So that's a problem.
But a bigger problem was that the Lakers were changing, most notably within the power dynamic between its veteran star, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and the emerging supernova that was Magic Johnson.
One thing that's really interesting is when Magic came to the Lakers, he was extremely deferential to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It was cap this, cap that. He's a legend. I'm a rookie. Get him the ball. Get him the ball.
But a year after deferring to the captain during his spectacular rookie year, Magic Johnson believed that the Lakers were his. You are listening to Westward on the Dan Patrick Podcast Network. We'll be right back.
I got stuck right in the middle of this, you know, kind of battle of who was number one. And I think I ran into some issues with that. I don't know necessarily with Magic, but I think with the rest of the team. From my vantage point, I treated Kareem as number one. There was no question. I wouldn't take too much credit. I saw that Kareem was the man. I mean, if you wanted a basket, if you wanted somebody to win a game for you, it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. However, as with Magic's rookie year to his second year, moving forward, Magic takes over. I mean, that's pretty clear.
While Kareem Abdul-Jabbar may have been seen as Coach Westhead's number one, it was also clear to many that owner Jerry Buss had his own number one.
Magic and Jerry Buss became buddies. And while that's great if you're Magic and great if you're Buss, if you're another player, especially a star player, you start wondering if he's getting special treatment. Is this just my imagination? Why is he always hanging out with the owner? And then when Magic Johnson gets this huge deal, you start saying, I've been here a lot longer than him. I have a lot more MVPs than this guy does. I'm the center. I'm one of the great players of all time.
When Magic signed his unheralded 25-year, $25 million contract, which, you know, was would blow everybody's mind at that time in the early 80s, now it'd be like a one-year deal. I think, and he never voiced any of this to me, but I think that Kareem was not pleased that management / Jerry Buss didn't treat him with the same financial high regard that he did Magic. So therein a separation or a rift began to take place. I don't think necessarily between Kareem and Magic directly, but between how the Lakers were treating him.
The Lakers would take a step back in Westhead's second year as the coach struggled to manage the team's changing dynamics.
I was a rank amateur in how to deal with players and all of the ins and outs of players and players' relationships and contracts and how to deal with people and how to, you know, not push too hard for one player because it will hurt the other player.
Navigating the team's personalities proved difficult, but what troubled Paul Westhead most was not whether the Laker team was Magic Johnson's or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's, but that the Laker team wasn't his. Because for 2 years, Coach Paul Westhead had kept a secret. It was a revolutionary offensive scheme that he had created while coaching during his off seasons at LaSalle. He called it the system.
When I was at LaSalle in the summers, that I would go down and coach in Puerto Rico, and the way they played. I mean, they played fast. They wanted to shoot fast. And my eyes popped out. I said, oh my gosh, I was thinking about this. And one of the things I learned, if you're going to be a fast break coach, don't have a lot of plays. In fact, don't have any plays. The more plays you put in, the slower your team goes. So there's a kind of direct proportion to that. And fortunately, coaches think that the bigger their playbook, the better they are, the more competent they are. And that may be true. But if you want to run the system, you better have a one sheet of paper playbook. And that's what you do.
Westhead had never fully implemented his system in college because both established coaches and players were reluctant to embrace it.
When I first tried to put it in, a coach at Old Dominion University, Sonny Allen, who was a fast break coach, and he did say to me, if you're going to do this, you have to be a little crazy because you're going to get laughed at. Nobody really wanted to run fast and play like this. They all wanted to follow the ritual of grinding it out. And to be honest with you, it's still going on today.
But after the team's difficult second year, Paul Westhead made the decision that would define a brand of basketball that would become the most heralded in NBA history.
The start of my third year, we had training camp in Palm Springs at COD, which is the College of the Desert. And I made the decision, you know, I'm established head coach, and now into my third year, I said, I have to do something to give us a boost and move into the championship level again. So I put the break in, and I do remember, and I talk about this in my book, The Speed Game. At the end, I figured, well, let me really show them we're going to be a running team. So we ran lines at the end of practice, up and down, up and down, up and down, which a lot of high school, college teams do. So we did it, a series of them, about 10 or 12. and the players are staggering to the locker room. And then Kareem comes over, puts his arm around me, and he says, "Paul, I don't do lines." And he walked away. So I learned a number of things from that. A, he didn't call me coach. He called me Paul, which, from what I hear, the only person he ever called coach was John Wooden. That's fair. Two, he was being honest enough with me to say, "And if you continue to do this, we could have a problem." And I surely didn't want to have a problem with Kareem. So I went back and reflected and I said, well, I'm never going to run lines again. So we didn't.
If you think that Magic Johnson and the Lakers may have taken to Westhead's fast break system as a natural fit, you would be wrong.
After two or three or four days, there was resistance among the players. They didn't like it. They objected to kind of, on their side, to their credit, it was something that they were unfamiliar with and it was hard. On my side, I was trying to convince them, if you just work harder, it'll get easy. And it's like a lot of things. You have to push, 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 and then you're on the other side of it, and then it flows.
Unfortunately, while Paul Westhead was their coach, his Laker players would never get to see the flow.
They only saw the hard. So we start the season and we didn't start out real well. Unfortunately, we lost our opener to Houston, the team that knocked us out the year before in the playoffs, of all teams to lose to. And then, you know, I lasted, whatever, 15 games.
Because more important than losing games, Paul Westhead had lost his star point guard, Magic Johnson.
It started out terrific. You know, I was there literally parts of three seasons with Magic and didn't have a bunch of problems with him. I think people suspected that the way it went down, that it just was one more problem with Paul Westhead and Magic Johnson. That would not have been accurate. He was all about winning. He was all about his team, especially, but in his rookie year, he was really like a power forward. He was getting everybody's rebound. He was doing all the dirty work. And that's why the players liked him, because he was giving himself up for his team. It didn't end well because I had an incident in Salt Lake City with him in my third season, and I didn't like the way he was not paying attention at a timeout at the end of a game, and we would have lost that game had the Utah Jazz player made the basket. So it wasn't like it was good defense. They just missed. So after the game, I brought him into another part of the locker room without the players around. I tried to give him the courtesy to not say anything in front of the players. And I said, this cannot continue, Magic. You cannot be distracted during these crucial times when I'm talking. And he just looked at me and walked away. The next day, Jerry Buss brought me in his office and fired me. So you could easily say, after the Magic incident, I got fired. Therefore, Magic was the problem. But I think it was deeper than that. The Lakers were almost looking for a reason to fire me. So Magic was the tipping point.
I don't think Magic treated Westhead very well. I think Magic undermined him. I think he wasn't very direct with him. He was a kid. It's excusable. One thing that's really interesting, I just want to say, is if you look at the NBA now, what happened then wouldn't be unusual now. Like that was the first time I can remember a player exercising power over a coach. That was a very new phenomenon at that point. Nowadays, if LeBron James wants Frank Vogel fired, he can do it in a second. You know, if Kawhi Leonard wants Ty Lue fired, he can do it in a second. Back then, that didn't happen. The coaches, the general managers, the owners, they had all the power. And Magic Johnson, I think you can make the argument, was the first player to have more power than his coach and his general manager. I always thought Westhead got a raw deal with the Lakers. You know, I thought the guy freaking was a really good coach.
It would be the first time in his professional career that Coach Paul Westhead would be fired.
The day I got fired, I went home and I was kind of devastated because this is the first time I got fired. And you really take it personal. Now I've been fired 14 times, so I don't take any of it personal. I'm a pro at getting fired. And I'm home with my family, and the kids left school. They were crying, and, you know, the whole nine yards.
But a call from the player he regarded as his number one would manage to lift his spirits.
About an hour after I'm home, I get a phone call from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And he says, Coach, I'm sorry to hear what happened. I want you to know I was not a part of this. And I want to thank you for the time that we were together. That was the one and only player who called me.
I feel like Kareem got it before people got it. I really do. I wish more athletes now got it. All these athletes who are being asked to play during COVID, all these college athletes, like, they're just using you. They come into your community. They make promises of a shiny locker room. They show you videotape of our big locker room at Texas. So each locker costs blah, blah, blah. Then they bring you there. They don't give a shit about your education at all. And then they spit you out, and you leave without a degree half the time, and you're stocking shelves at Home Depot, and a customer comes up to you and say, weren't you that guy who played at Ohio State? It's such a corrupt system. And he understood it early on. The beauty of Kareem is he was just going to use it. Like, instead of letting them use him, he was going to use it to his advantage too. And he would make his money, and he would continue to educate himself. And he wasn't going to get caught up in not having a 7-Up commercial, not being on TV, all that. You know, he didn't need the celebrity. And I think Magic, on the other hand, dove right in. Celebrity, he loves celebrity. He loved being the center of attention. You know, you're going to pay me to play basketball? That's amazing.
When asked if he would do anything differently, Westhead is candid.
If I'm being practical now, I should have stayed with the lesson plan that Jack McKinney left me. And let Pat Riley figure out his own lesson plan. And so much for lesson plans from former teachers or coaches. And that is precisely what Scott Osler said to me, who was then the beat writer for the LA Times. He said to me, Paul, you had the best team in the world. You had the best owner in the world who would get you players. You lived in the best city in the world, in Los Angeles. You were the highest paid coach in professional basketball. Why would you ever change? And I said, Scott, that's a good question.
The irony of Paul Westhead's firing was that it was his system that Pat Riley would run and would become the hallmark of the Showtime dynasty.
Pat Riley did a very good job of running my fast break. And he ran it, I wouldn't say he ran the system better, but he handled the players better. You know, he was a person who could maneuver the players and convince them that this is a good way.
So who then is responsible for Showtime?
I think you could probably make the argument, and it's a fair argument, that McKinney begat Westhead and Westhead begat Riley, and they kind of morphed into each other.
The birth of the Showtime era and the influence it had on the game of professional basketball is immeasurable.
First of all, every big point guard who handles the ball now, every Kevin Durant type guy, should write a letter of thank you to Magic Johnson for showing that this can be done and it's okay, and that little guards aren't going to steal the ball every time you dribble, and that it works well. Every team that doesn't slog the ball up the court slow and set up an offense, the run and gun, the slashing and gunning, the birth of that kind of basketball comes from those Showtime teams.
But for the writer Jeff Perlman, the era is most memorable for something that happened off the basketball court.
Whenever I think of Showtime, the thing I think of first, I swear to God, and I bring this up all the time, is Magic Johnson arriving in LA for the first time. And he's being driven by a limousine to meet Jerry Buss. And he has the car stop because he sees oranges growing on a tree. And he opens a door and he picks an orange. And he's just blown away by this idea of an orange growing on a tree. And I realized, I always think of the NBA, the birth of the modern NBA, as Magic Johnson plucking an orange off a tree. And just this magic of that moment and the sunshine and the forum and the palm trees. It was so Magic Johnson at, you know, as a teen, he's just a teenager, he's just a kid, and he just wants a burger. and he wants to pick an orange off a tree, and he wants to come to L.A. It's kind of a beautiful merging of worlds.
Boy, is he playing some ball?
He really is. Rebound hit by Kareem to Scott. Here they go again. It's showtime.
Fate had brought the Lakers to Los Angeles. Will had brought them into the possession of Jerry Buss. And though it was his ownership that redefined, reinvigorated, and reestablished the moribund NBA, it was the magic of chance that brought a kid all the way from East Lansing, Michigan, to Los Angeles, just so that he could pick an orange before his Los Angeles Lakers would change the landscape of sports and culture in America.
Next time on Westward.
In 1981, the same year that the Showtime era was in the early stages of launching the entire league into the stratosphere of cultural and commercial relevance, another basketball era was taking root 120 miles south of L.A., down California's 405 freeway.
We became a joke, you know, because we couldn't fill the arena. And I was always saying, Dad, you don't understand what's going on. This whole thing is changing now. And I guess he got to a point where he thought, this is not going to work here. And so he decided to sell.
The buyer's name was Donald Sterling.
At some point, my dad said he was coming down, book us some time at Lubach's, which is a big restaurant in San Diego. But I'm going to warn you, this guy's a little weird.
In the 3 years they had been in San Diego, the Clippers had posted a poor but bearable 114-132 record. But under a Donald Sterling ownership, that would come to be known as a golden age of Clipper basketball.
I felt the year that I was there in Irv owned the team, they didn't cut corners. They weren't telling us to, you know, cut the budget and, you know, watch spending on this or that. And that's what dramatically changed when Sterling bought the team.
Well, the biggest problem was, I think, with didn't want to spend the money. You know, coming there, teams, and, you know, we need to do, buy, and stuff like that.
The first year he owns the team, and we also were told, don't cash our paychecks because they're not any good. Just hold on to them, and we'll tell you when you can put them in the bank.
The absurdity of it all only reinforced the mounting failures of the Donald Sterling-owned Clippers.
I'm comfortable here, and I'm happy here, and I just want to stay here in San Diego.
Does this mean that the team will stay here indefinitely?
Absolutely.
Sterling absolutely did not. And though he would remain in San Diego through the next two seasons, he would spend his time there running the franchise into the ground.
Westward is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network, iHeartRadio, and Joy Road Entertainment in association with Workhouse Media and Sugar 23. Executive produced by Paul Anderson and Nick Pinella for Workhouse Media and by Michael Sugar and Mike Mayer for Sugar 23. Joy Road Entertainment is P.G. Cuccieri, Jim Young, Matthew Hatchett, Tim Livingston, and I'm Bobby Glanton Smith.
Audio produced by Casey Wayland of Wayland Productions and edited by Neil Cabana. Producers would like to thank Ira Goldberg, Lon Levin, Paul Westhead, Jessica Bryden, and Jeff Perlman for their contributions. And of course, the great Jerry West.